First, let us warm up. All right, warming up. What is it that we learned during the last few sessions? What was new that we did not know earlier and now we came to learn? I'll tell you myself before you tell me. All right. Then you help me. If I forget something, you will intervene and tell me. All right. Right? So first, I think the first chapter of the Life Divine that we are studying is like a stethoscope. You know what is a stethoscope? You know what it is? Every doctor carries a stethoscope. It examines the rate of respiration. So Sri Aurobindo is like a doctor and he wants to examine the rate of respiration of humanity. The whole humanity is to be examined. And the first chapter is like a stethoscope. That is why the very first chapter is called human aspiration. Aspiration is breath, isn't it? It's breathing. So Sri Aurobindo is asking what is the kind of breathing that human beings are having. So when he examines his breath, he finds there's a constant breathing, but from time to time it forsakes. The breathing is not very, very sound. It's not very regular. So this aspiration of mankind, if on the whole you want to see what is the breathing, it simply breathes God, life, freedom, immortality. This is the breathing all the time in humanity. When it falls sick, it becomes skeptical. Skepticism is the melody. From time to time, it wanders and wanders. Wanders and wanders, wanders away from its normal breathing. Now, what's the meaning of skepticism? Can you tell me? Skepticism, S-C-E-P-T-I-C-I-S-M. Skepticism. Skepticism is a sign of sickness. The mood to doubt is called skepticism. To be skeptical means to have the mood to doubt. Right? So when mankind is sound in health, there is no doubt in the mind of the patient, of humanity. The humanity breathes quite well and it breathes with God, light, freedom, immortality. If you leave the whole mankind in its normal condition, when it is really breathing quite nicely, the only breath that you have is God, light, freedom, immortality. Only breath. It's actually, you know, if you see the whole human history, it's very interesting. The whole human history is like the breathing of the humanity. The whole history of mankind is nothing but breath of mankind. What is mankind doing all the time? What is it breathing? What is the mankind doing all the time? See, if you look at the whole history of mankind, if you take a telescope and put your telescope on humanity's whole history, thousands of years, and if you turn your telescope on the sky of humanity, the only breath you find is God, light, freedom, immortality. You take your telescope to ancient Egypt and you find pyramids coming up. It's also a breath, breathing of Egypt. It's a huge structure reaching out to God, light, freedom, immortality. If you go to Sumerian civilization, Assyrian civilization, it's the same thing. If you go to the early times of Abraham, Moses, same thing, God's commandment, 10 commandments of God. It's also breathing with God, God, freedom, light. You go to Greece, same thing, you hear Socrates, you hear Plato. What are they doing? What are they calling out? Again, God, light, freedom, immortality. We shall study Socrates and Plato particularly in due course. I'll take 6 lectures on this Socrates and Plato very soon. And we shall hear them also, God, light, freedom, immortality. Socrates said, when I'm taking hemlock, He was asked by the Athenians. He was misunderstood and he was told that he was corrupting the youth. Young people are always beloved and they all want to protect youth. And people said, you are corrupting the youth, therefore you take poison and die. That was the punishment given to him. But even on the deathbed, what does he say? He said, I am immortal. That's his message. He said, I am immortal. Maybe I am more fortunate than you are, he said. You are going to live with dead people, I am going to live with immortal people, he said. And if you read Plato, what does Plato say? He said, we are all bound in a small cave. He says, supposing that there is a cave in which there are lots of pillars, and each one of us is tied to each one pillar. Imagine, he said, mankind is nothing but prisoners tied to small pillar, who can only look in one direction, they cannot look back. And there is a huge sunlight over there, and in between you and the sunlight, there is a big crowd of people. And what do you see on the wall? Only shadows. Isn't it? So he said, we are all seeing only shadows here, imprisoned in the cave, not able to turn this way or that way, looking only in one direction. But aspiring for what? One prisoner gets out of his imprisonment, turns backwards and says, my Lord, glory of the sun on the other side, goes out of the cave, discovers the beautiful origin of all light. And he calls out and says to everybody, listen, here is the origin of everything. Turn backwards and see light. So it's the same message, God's light, freedom, immortality. You go to Rome, the same story you again and again find. Go to India, my Lord, India is like a cathedral, a huge cathedral, in which the only thing that counts is God, light, freedom, immortality, all the time. The one mantra in India. So Sri Aurobindo says, if you look at the breath of mankind with a stethoscope, the only breath you find is God, light, freedom, immortality. But sometimes as humanity falls sick, it gets overcome by skepticism. It doubts. Is there really God? Is there really light? Is there really freedom? Is there really immortality? This is the doubt. And Sri Aurobindo says that if you examine the longest period of skepticism, longest period of doubt, at the end, once again, sickness goes away, mankind becomes healthy, and again God, light, freedom, immortality. This is the constant refrain of human history. Right? This is the first paragraph of the Life Divine. One summary. Look at the whole history of mankind, summarize the whole history of mankind, and this is only four words come out, God, light, freedom, immortality. I think this is a new thing that we learned, summarizing of the whole history of mankind in one line. Now second thing, what did we learn? We learned the basis of this illness of mankind, the skepticism. From where does the skepticism come? From contradiction. This is one word to be remembered. There is a sense of contradiction in this world. It is this contradiction which comes to you like a challenge. In the presence of contradiction, you can't rest. As long as the contradiction remains, you remain dissatisfied, restless. You want to overcome the contradiction. But you must know, what is this contradiction? So Sri Aurobindo defines for us, what is this contradiction? Contradiction is existence of matter. This existence of matter, which seems to be insensible, unconscious, insentient, which doesn't feel anything, which has no light in it, no intelligence in it. This is the basic fact of life. Wherever we turn around, there is insensitivity. And yet we talk of God, life, freedom, immortality. So this is a contradiction. In the world of matter, where everywhere you face matter, you face this kind of contradiction. You are breathing for God. This contradiction is the main study of philosophy. If anybody asks you, what is philosophy? In one word, philosophy is dealing with the contradiction. If this contradiction did not exist, there is no need of philosophy at all. There are many contradictions in the world, but this one big contradiction, the biggest contradiction is existence of matter and the breathing for God, life, freedom and immortality. Because of this contradiction, Mankind is moving between one pole and the other pole. It swings. Is this right or is that right? Towards which shall we move? What shall we embrace? What shall we embrace so that we feel completely fulfilled? We want to be fulfilled. This is the basic fact. We want harmony. That's what Sri Aurobindo says. All problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. Right? It's a great sentence you remember. Beautiful sentence. All problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. Because of the contradiction, we feel that there should be harmonization. And then we begin to understand how this world, the details of the world, we begin to understand better. The whole world is nothing but a song of harmony. It's a music of harmony. Matter and life are opposed to each other, and yet it is in matter that life is to manifest. There is nothing in the world which is alive, which is not in a case of matter. All life in the world is in a capsule which consists of matter, and yet both are opposed to each other, and both are harmonized. Not fully, but sufficiently. Life and mind are opposed to each other, and they are also trying to live together. There is no human thought which is not vibrating in life. All mental thinking presupposes breathing. One who does not breathe cannot think. Such is the condition in this world. If you don't breathe, you cannot think. All thinking implies breathing exercise. Some kind of breathing should be before you can think. So there is a harmonization of life and the mind. Therefore, we can look for a greater harmony. The imperfections of matter and life, imperfections of life and mind, these imperfections can be completely bridged, and that is supramental existence. The supermind in matter, that is the ideal towards which we are moving. Then there will be total harmony, complete harmony. Then the promise will be fulfilled. There will be no problem then, because harmony will be achieved. So we learn first of all the human history, the real breath. Secondly, we learn what is the contradiction in this world, which gives rise to philosophy. Then we found out where exactly is this contradiction, and how the contradiction is constantly striving to arrive at harmony. And then we found out the fourth thing, that there is a deeper law in this world of evolution. The whole world is in a process of evolution. It's a new fact we discovered. The entire fourth paragraph of the Life Divine, first chapter, is devoted to evolution. And Sri Aurobindo very briefly gives us life in matter, mind in life, and supermind in mind. Four terms of evolution. Life in matter, mind in life, and supermind in mind. This is what we have learned so far. Alright. This is one summary of what we have learned so far. Every statement is a new statement for us. We did not know the whole history of mankind. In one little paragraph, Sri Aurobindo gave us the whole history of mankind. He gave a stethoscope by which he could measure the respiration of mankind. Then we discovered the contradiction. Then we found the urge for harmonization. Then we learned of evolution. So four words we learned. Aspiration for God, light, freedom, immortality. The big contradiction. Big movement of harmony. And a big movement of evolution. Four terms we learned. But we learned something much more also. We learned the art of philosophy. In fact, all of you can be proud that you have in your hands the real art of philosophy. You may not be self-conscious about it, but whatever you have learned so far has given you, very briefly, that is the greatness of this book, Life Divine. What people take 20 years to learn, I myself learned after 20 years what is the art of philosophizing, which you have the advantage of learning within 2 months, the art of philosophizing. As I told you, the first art of philosophizing arises from the fact of contradiction. There is no philosophizing if there is not a fact of contradiction. Philosophical thinking starts from the fact of contradiction. If you are not confronted with contradiction, there is no movement towards philosophizing. A contradiction is a challenge which asks you to harmonize. So all philosophy is nothing but an attempt to harmonize a contradiction. That is philosophy. All philosophy is nothing but this, attempt to harmonize a contradiction. You look at all the books of philosophy, you open any book of philosophy, it's nothing but some presentation of a contradiction, and then philosophers trying to harmonize. So you now know what is philosophy, basically. Presentation of contradiction and the attempt to harmonize by which contradiction can be resolved. And then you did something more. You learned different forms of philosophical argument. Different forms of philosophical argument. First you learned epistemological argument. Right? You write it down again. Epistemological argument. E-P-I-S-T-E-M-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. Epistemological argument. You become a good philosopher when you learn the art of epistemological argument. Then you learn dialectical argument. Then you learn the historical argument. Then you learn the quintessential metaphysical argument. And then you learn causal argument. What is the epistemological argument? Epistemological argument, all argument in philosophy starts with facts. Where there are no facts, there are no philosophical arguments. So all these arguments start with certain facts. So epistemological argument starts with a fact. Fact of the nature of thought. From the nature of thought, you derive a conclusion, that is epistemological argument. You make a statement that all thought is of this nature. That's the first statement. In any epistemological argument, the first statement will be, nature of thought is such and such. Because of that reason, the conclusion is this. That is the nature of epistemological argument. All epistemological argument starts with the nature of thought, a statement of the nature of thought. Thought being so and so, the nature of thought being so and so, therefore it follows whatever is to be followed. You derive. All argumentation is derivation. You imply, you bring out what is inside a fact. You as it were fathom into the depths of the nature of thought, and then you derive a conclusion. You bring out a jewel out of the ocean of thought and put it forward. That is epistemological argument. It's like diving into the ocean of thought. Now what was the example of epistemological argument? Now I won't answer this question. We had an example of the epistemological argument. From the nature of thought something was derived. You can study the first paragraph, I can only give you a hint. If you study the first paragraph, you have the argument, one example of epistemological argument. You can open the book, it is open book examination. In the very first paragraph, you have an epistemological argument. Got it? Read out. Continue.
From its survives Shalom's period of skepticism and return after every generation.
Continue.
Is also the highest which is thought can predict and
then you say, good. This sentence is an argument, epistemological argument. It tells you what is the highest that thought can envisage. It gives you the argument of thought, nature of thought. What is the nature of thought? And the argument is conclusive. Is. There is no is, seems, probable, not such words at all. It's a complete argument. It's complete conclusion. The earliest preoccupation of man in his awakened thought is also the highest that thought can envisage. This argument is epistemological argument. If you examine the nature of thought, then you will find it is equivalent to the earliest occupation, preoccupation of man in his awakened thought. This is epistemological argument. No escape from it. If you really go to the highest of thought, it will come to only one thing, God, life, freedom, immortality. The highest that the thought can envisage is God, life, freedom, immortality. It is again the earliest occupation of man, and it returns again and again in mankind. It is something that highest that the thought can envisage. You climb up the highest ladder of thought, then having reached all around, if you look up, inevitably you will see only God, life, freedom, immortality. So this statement is an epistemological statement. It's an epistemological argument. All right, now let us see what was the historical argument. It's a good answer. Huh? I like it very much. Very nice. Bravo. Now let us see what was the historical argument. It is also in the first paragraph. Found it? Yes? Tell me.
The ancient dawns of human knowledge have left us their witnesses to its constant aspirations. Today we see humanity satiated but not satisfied by rigorous analysis of the externality of nature, preparing to return to its primeval longings. The earliest formula of wisdom promises to be its last, God's life.
Excellent. Bravo to you. This is the historical argument. Sri Aurobindo says that if you look at the history, you first go to the earliest records of mankind. Then you see the today. You see the earliest past, then you see today. From there now you derive for the future. So earliest, present, and you derive the future. So historical argument tells you what has been the past, what is the present, and then you derive from it the conclusion for the future. That's historical argument, very simple. Now there is a difference between epistemological argument and historical argument. I told you at that time, historical arguments are never conclusive. Whenever you make a historical argument, the future may seem to be probable, but shows a great probability or lesser probability. The historical argument, the value of the historical argument is, it gives you a sense of the highest possible probability. It never gives you complete conclusiveness. You might say that is the weakness of the historical argument, but also strength of it, because it is never dogmatic. It can never be turned into a dogma. It always keeps you open to the future. So you see the very statement of the argument, the earliest formula of wisdom, then the word is, he doesn't say, is also the formula of the future. See the language that Sri Aurobindo uses. The earliest formula of wisdom, what is the word that Sri Aurobindo uses? The earliest formula of wisdom promises. Now the word promise is not conclusive. He doesn't say will be or shall be, but it only promises, gives you the highest probability. It's only a promise. It promises that future will be same formula. Alright, whereas in epistemological argument, he doesn't say promises. You revise again the epistemological argument and see the difference. You had read out that sentence. Now what is the nature of that sentence?
No.
You see the conclusion. The earliest preoccupation? Yes? Is, yes. The word used is, not promises. An epistemological argument always gives you a categorical state. It affirms without doubt. There is no doubt left. It is. The earliest preoccupation is also what the highest thought can envisage. Is also. It doesn't say seems. The epistemological argument is based upon the nature of thought. Whenever there is something based upon nature of thought, conclusion is always categorical. There is no doubt about it. It is conclusive. Historical argument, the highest historical argument, if you are really a good historian, you may forecast, good, but you cannot say shall or will or is. You will say it seems, probably, promises, very likely, most likely it will happen. That is the nature of historical argument. Right? So, you have learnt now very nicely what is epistemological argument, what is historical argument. Now let us see what we have learnt about dialectical argument. What is a dialectical argument? Where is the example of dialectical argument? The second paragraph contains the dialectical argument. Yes? You have it? It's very easy if you read the very first sentence. The very first sentence of the second paragraph is a statement which is dialectical argument. Let us first define what is dialectical argument. We have defined epistemological argument as an argument which states the nature of thought and derives a conclusion from it. That is epistemological argument. Historical argument states past, present, and derives conclusion about the future. Now similarly, dialectical argument, it states a fact, but a fact of contradiction. And having stated a contradiction, it derives a conclusion. A contradiction means there is a thesis and there is an antithesis. And having seen the thesis and the antithesis, Having seen the contradiction between the two, you derive a conclusion which is synthesis. So nature of dialectical argument is presentation of thesis, antithesis and derivation of synthesis. Alright. So if you read the second paragraph, what does it say? Read the second paragraph. These persistent ideals are contradicted, that is God, life, freedom, immortality, are contradicted by normal experience of mankind. It's a contradiction. Contradiction between the ideal and normal experience, thesis and antithesis. So the entire second paragraph is an attempt to resolve this contradiction. So the entire second paragraph is a dialectical argument. Alright, so this is the third example we have now. Epistemological, historical, dialectical. Then we have quintessential metaphysical argument. That is the fourth kind of an argument. Quintessential metaphysical argument. Metaphysics, we have decided, what was metaphysics? Metaphysics is the study of the highest reality and also the meaning of the highest reality. Not only what is ultimately real, but also what is ultimately meaningful. This word meaning is very important. You have no metaphysics unless you raise the question of meaning. What is the significance? Meaning. What is the meaning of this class, for example? If you ask this question, what is the meaning of this class? That question is a metaphysical question. Now give me an example here. In the second paragraph, you will find an example of the quintessential metaphysical argument. The quintessential metaphysical argument is towards the end of the second paragraph. If you concentrate upon the second paragraph and see towards the end, you will get a very good example of a quintessential metaphysical argument. Aaron, can you read the last few lines of that paragraph?
But the epithet cannot be a unified view of the world's wisdom.
Good.
The direct opposition of rather a thought of natural thoughts underestimated and not the seal of the current complex assumption.
Good. But if we take, what is the important word? If you take what attitude, what view?
Deliberate.
That's right. This word is important. If you take a deliberate view, deliberate means if you try to find out the meaning. All deliberate, when you say you did deliberately, means you did many meaningfully. Isn't it? When you do something, when you speak a word and you say, oh, I simply spoke like that, then it's not deliberate. But when you say, no, there was deliberate meaning in you. When you spoke words, you really meant it. So, all sense of meaning is contained in deliberate thinking. So Sri Aurobindo says, if you take a deliberate view, then the same facts will present themselves quite in a new way. The bird is crying now, and we may say it is simply a cry. But if you take a deliberate view, you know, there is a view that all birds have a language. And if you understand the word, that the cries of the birds, you can find out the meaning. They can tell you of the things that are going to happen tomorrow. In India, there is a science, you know, to learn the language of the birds. Even in the villages in India, you say that now, if a crow goes on crowing the whole day, it means a guest is going to come tomorrow. You may call it a superstition, but in any case, it's a quintessential metaphysical argument. Because the bird is crying, the crow is crying, therefore, what does it mean? What is the message of it? It means the guest is coming tomorrow. Now, this conclusion is a quintessential metaphysical argument. If you know how to read the language, you can be sure about it. There's no question. It's like an announcer. When an announcer says that now the drama will start in 5 minutes' time, then you all get ready to watch the drama. It's a quintessential meaning, because when the announcer announces, there's a meaning in it. It will be fulfilled. So when you see the facts of the world, and then you ask, is there any meaning in these facts? So when you try to derive the meaning out of the facts, it's a quintessential metaphysical argument. Or now the last argument, that is causal argument. About causation I have told you a lot. I don't expect that you should remember all that I spoke, not at all. Many things which are spoken are something like the rainwater. Unless you harvest the rainwater goes on flowing away. So similarly, much that I speak is like rainwater. I don't expect that you'll be able to harvest all that I'm speaking. But from time to time you can come back again, and then you begin to harvest. So I come back again to causal argument. I told you last time, I spoke to you about Aristotle. Let us remember now. I spoke to you about Aristotle. And he said that a cause is always related to an effect. That's the first definition of a cause. Cause always produces an effect. This is very simple. Aristotle made no great announcement by saying that every cause is that which causes effect. Very simple, any child can say, very simply. But what was good, what was wise in his analysis was, he said that in every cause there are four aspects. It is these four aspects which are very important. Every cause has in it four aspects. And as a result there are four names which are given to a cause. A cause may be a material cause, a cause may be a formal cause, a cause may be efficient cause, and a cause may be final cause. So I have given you four words, final. First is material cause. Second is, Aram, what is the second one? Formal cause. Third one is, I tell you again. First is material cause. Second is efficient cause. Third is formal cause. Fourth is final cause. You don't worry about the sequence. There are four causes. Material, efficient, formal, and final. Alright, tell me the four ones. Material, formal, efficient, good. A cause may be formal cause, may be efficient cause, may be material cause, may be final cause. Alright. If you are a carpenter and you make a chair, then carpenter is a material cause or wood is a material cause? Tell me. Is carpenter the material cause or wood is a material cause? Wood, correct. Why? Because the matter of the chair is wood. So material cause of the chair is the wood. Therefore wood is a material cause. In what sense then is the carpenter the cause of the chair? Is he final cause, formal cause, or is he efficient cause? Efficient cause, good. The carpenter is the efficient cause. What is the formal cause?
Idea.
Good, the idea. Who spoke this? Oh, good, excellent. The idea of the form of the chair, the form of the chair, the idea of the chair, the form of the chair is the formal cause. And now tell me, what is the final cause?
Chair.
Chair is already form, formal cause. Chair is a form, isn't it, idea?
Purpose?
Good, the purpose for which the chair is cause. For what did you make the chair? It's a final cause. For anything that happens or any effect, you should look for this fourth thing. If you sow a seed in order that the tree may come out, now analyze to me the four causes. What is the material cause? What is the final cause? What is the efficient cause? What is the formal cause? Good, excellent. Material cause is the seed. The seed is the material cause. It is that seed which becomes a tree. Excellent. The seed is the material cause. Now what is the efficient cause? Let us see. Pardon? Yes, who has put the farmer, right? The farmer is the cause. What cause? Farmer is the efficient cause. Good. What is the formal cause? You tell me, what is the formal cause? The form of the tree. Form of the tree is the formal cause. And what's the final cause? Tell me.
For the purpose of why, for what?
What was the purpose? Supposing you are farming.
For the mangoes.
For the mangoes, good. So that you can feed your children. That's the final cause. You want that children should enjoy sweetness of the mango and be nourished. That is the final cause. Now you give me an example, we shall analyze it. You take any effect and then tell me, take up any effect in the world. There are so many effects in the world. Let us take French Revolution. French Revolution, you know about French Revolution, no? You know French Revolution? No? History of French Revolution? One day I shall tell you the story of French Revolution. Every human being of the modern times should learn French Revolution. You cannot understand what is happening today without understanding what happened in French Revolution. Such is the importance of French Revolution. What we are doing today is causally connected with French Revolution. One of the greatest events of world history is French Revolution. So one day we shall study French Revolution. Alright, make it in your itinerary for 10 years. We are already programming for 10 years. Remember, our contract is for 10 years. So one day in these 10 years, we shall spend some time on French Revolution. It's a one effect which you must learn. Alright, then you don't take just now because you don't know French Revolution. you can't answer my question. You take any event, take up anything that you know, and then you shall try to analyze the four causes. Let us say Auroville. Auroville is an event, you know. It's a consequence. Now, what is the efficient cause of Auroville? Pardon? Aurovillians, yes? The mother, correct. She pushed the idea of Auroville, no? She shaped. She hasn't given the shape. So she is the efficient cause of Auroville. Good. What is the formal cause of Auroville? Not bad. Pardon? Dream, yes? The charter of Auroville. Charter of Auroville is the formal cause of Auroville. Then, what is the material cause? The place, the soil, the children of Auroville, the parents of Auroville, administrators of Auroville, we are all material causes. We are the matter of Auroville. So that's the material cause of Auroville. And what's the final cause of Auroville? Chandran, you will tell me. What's the final cause of Auroville? Huh? What's the purpose? Huh? Human unity. Excellent. Human unity is the final cause of Auroville. Excellent. Very good. Now you have mastered almost. Aristotle will be very happy to know that in 20th century, in one corner of the earth, there are some bubbling young children who have mastered his theory of causation. Now, I have told you causal argument. This is what Aristotle had said about causation. I have told you also about Indian theory. I have given you two Sanskrit words. I shall repeat them. Two Sanskrit words I have given you. Asat Karyavada and Sat Karyavada. I don't know if you remember at all, even in the echo of the past. Doesn't matter, even if you don't remember, because they are Sanskrit words, they are difficult words. But now in the future you remember. Asat Karyavada, A-S-A-T, Asat. Karya, K-A-R-Y-A, Karya. Vada, V-A-D-A. Asat Karyavada. And the other word is Sat Karyavada. The word A is dropped. Sat Karyavada. Asat Karyavada and Sat Karyavada. I have told you the meanings of these two words, I shall repeat. Karya means effect. The event, the effect. Sat means that which exists. Vada means theory. A theory of the effect which presents that which exists. Sat Karyavada. A theory which says that effect was already existing before it came out. That's called Sat Karyavada. Master, I am repeating what I said at the last. The effect was already existing in the form of the cause. So according to this theory of Sat Karyavada, it's a theory according to which the cause existed already in the cause. I'm sorry, the effect already exists in the cause. A Sat Karyavada says that effect did not exist in the cause. So there are two theories in India. According to one theory, for every effect, there must be a cause. Both the theories agree on this. Effect presupposes a cause. There must be a cause from which effect is derived. But according to one theory, effect already existed in the cause. According to another theory, effect did not exist in the cause. According to this theory, the tree already exists in the seed. Tree is an effect. So according to this theory, the tree already existed in the cause, namely in the seed. According to Asat Karyavada, tree did not exist in the seed. And there are arguments for both. We shall study later on, when you are more mature, we shall study the arguments for both. Both are very interesting arguments. Now, Sri Aurobindo argues in favor of Sat Karyavada. You will see that argument, Sat Karyavada. Now, you will find out where Sri Aurobindo has put the Sat Karyavada. Where Sri Aurobindo says, effect already exists in the cause. This argument Sri Aurobindo puts forward in the fourth paragraph of the first chapter. That is what I said, causal argument. Did you find it? Where is the argument? Now read the argument. First, fourth paragraph.
These are the evolution of life in matter, the evolution of the mind in matter, but the evolution is a world which merely states the phenomenon without its own being. For there seems to be no reason why life should evolve out of material elements or mind out of living forms unless the effect of
solution. Right? Now where exactly is this causal argument? You have read the whole sentence, which is very good. That is, there is a causal argument there. Now you just pick up those few words where the causal argument is really, where the causal argument is really stated. There is no reason why life should come out of matter. It must be only because life was already in matter. There is no reason why mind should come out of life, because mind was already in life. Not only that, but more than that, life is nothing but matter, and matter is nothing but life. Identical, actually. Matter is a veiled form of life, and life is a veiled form of mind. It's like the seed and the tree. The seed is nothing but the veiled tree. Tree which is already in the seed, but is veiled. You cannot see it. It's veiled. Similarly, life is already in matter. Not only already in matter, but matter itself is veiled life. And mind is not only already in life, but life, mind itself. The life itself is a veiled mind. Alright. So now we have revised all the four paragraphs that we had done so far. I summarized in two sentences. I said first that Sri Aurobindo's argument has been the study of human history, past, present and future. And his argument is that if you look at the past, there was only one breath, God, life, freedom, immortality. If you see the present, you find that there is today cessation but no satisfaction. And there is already a preparation of humanity returning to the primal longing of God, life, freedom, immortality. This is the first argument of this chapter. It's summarizing the whole human history and leaping beyond the present and showing to the future. Right? The second aspect of the first four paragraphs is various forms of philosophical argument. Epistemological argument, and what are the other arguments? Now you tell me. Epistemological argument, dialectical argument, historical argument, pardon, quintessential metaphysical argument, causal argument. Excellent. Now I think you will never forget these two sentences which I have spoken today. Alright. I think tomorrow when you come, please write down everyone. Only these two sentences. Alright. This is your lifetime companion for all philosophical journey. This is sufficient. If you know this much, your whole travel to philosophical world will be very, very easy. I think we shall do the fifth paragraph tomorrow. Alright, I wanted to today, but revision has taken long time. Not too much? Not tired? Alright? Thank you.